This is Circe Olson Wessner. I'm the director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Tejeros, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Together We Serve. I'm speaking to Claudia Reisner, retired Navy captain, who lives right up the road from me, but we're doing this interview by phone because we are social distancing due to the pandemic. Hi, Claudia.
Hi, Circe. Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. I wanted to say, you know, to our listeners, we are in New Mexico here, and so we're going to have a nice conversation today about all sorts of things. So you retired after 29 years in the Navy, and I've been looking over your bio, and you had a pretty interesting career in some very exotic places. But first, I wanted to ask you, were you from a military family? What compelled you to join the Navy?
You know, I've heard that question before, Circe.
I imagine.
No, I really don't come from a military family. My father served in the Air Force for a few years, but did not make a career of it. My uncle was in the Army for a couple years, but of the four children, you know, none of us had any compelling reason to join. But I grew up in Chicago, and I studied marketing, and I got a job in advertising, and I really loved it for the first couple of years. And then it just felt like I needed to go out and see the world. I needed to look over the horizon. And I wanted to do something kind of bigger than myself, than just a job. Mm-hmm. And serving my country really fit. I went out and I interviewed with all the different branches of the military, including the Coast Guard. I even went to the Peace Corps. And I settled on the Navy. I was really, really happy with that decision. Being from kind of a landlocked area, even though we had Lake Michigan, right, I was drawn to the sea. So the Navy was just a very good fit. I wanted to see the world, do some traveling, and serve my country.
What year was that?
I joined in 1981. And that was when we still, President Reagan had just been sworn in, and we still had a lot of the combat exclusion laws in place, meaning that me joining the Navy, I couldn't serve on most of the ships because they're warships. I couldn't be a pilot, and I couldn't serve on a submarine. So they were bringing more and more women into the service than anticipating a change in the laws. So they stationed us ashore. They trained us to be able to do a lot of different things. And we're trying to get us through the leadership pipeline to see when things would change and we could dive into some of these more specialized areas.
Well, I see that you were stationed in some very exotic places, Malaysia, Diego Garcia, you were in the Netherlands, you were in Italy, and then you were, of course, in California and Virginia. But the place I had to laugh about was Albuquerque. What does the Navy do in the desert? Seriously.
Seriously, harken back to the days when the Rio Grande was flowing.
Yeah, well, that was before your time, I'm sure.
Yeah, before anyone's time. Actually, I was brought here for recruiting. Mm. All branches of the military recruit in every state. Mm. So Naval Recruiting District Albuquerque covered all of New Mexico and all of Arizona. And it was my first time here. And I really kind of fell in love with it. It was very interesting because when you're recruiting, you've got different recruiters and stations throughout the two states. We had 122 stations throughout these two states. And as the executive officer, that's the second in charge, I would go out periodically and travel and see the different recruiting stations and recruiters and try to help them in their efforts. And I was so impressed with how beautiful this area is. You know, Chicago and Illinois are as flat as you can be, nothing but cornfields. And then you come here and you've got these mountains, these vistas, and the sky. We just fell in love with it. But I got to tell you, recruiting was a little challenging. People actually thought that Top Gun was a movie about the Air Force.
Yeah. Well,
yeah. And the Navy would not have Air Force planes landing on our carriers.
So people don't think much of, Navy pilots as much as they think of Air Force pilots, maybe.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And we actually have probably more aircraft and pilots in the Navy than any other service. But we talked to a lot of young people, and they wanted change. And it kind of reminded me of why I wanted to join the Navy. Mm-hmm. So it was really a good opportunity to offer them something completely away from home. Mm-hmm. And we did well. We made quotas both in the enlisted and the officer goals mm-hmm. most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems a lot of your duty assignments were overseas, too. So what were some of the other positions you held?
Yeah, and the overseas was really by my request and my doing. Certainly, I had to work within the system and fill the needs of the Navy, but I really wanted to travel overseas. So my first overseas duty station was Diego Garcia. And we kind of jokingly call it the garden spot of the Indian Ocean. It's a tiny little archipelago mm-hmm. that's owned by the Brits that the U.S. military leases for a few bucks a year. And it's a good pre-positioning location.
Mm-hmm.
So I ran the military sea lift there during the Somalian operation called Restore Hope. That was, the 92-93 time frame.
Mm-hmm.
And next time I went overseas, it was to the Netherlands, and I was stationed at our embassy. I was the chief of the Office of Defense Cooperation for the Navy, and that basically was me working with defense contractors selling weapons systems, torpedoes, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. radar, mm-hmm. to the Royal Netherlands Navy, and then arranging for all the training. And we covered the training through most of Northwestern Europe out of that office. And that was my first experience, working with the diplomatic corps, and I really enjoyed it. Mm. So I was stationed in the Netherlands for 3 years, and I was screened by our internal personnel system and selected for command while I was there. And they offered me a number of different postings, and I chose to be the commanding officer of the naval support activity in Italy. Mm. And that was in a beautiful little island off the western coast of Italy between Corsica.
Uh-huh.
A pretty little place. We had a tender there, and there were about 2,700 Americans, families, civilians, sailors, and I was in charge of the base and all the other operations that supported that ship and the ship's mission.
I'm curious, Claudia, you mentioned a tender. When I think of a tender, I think of those little boats that come off of the cruise ship, so I'm assuming a tender is something better than that.
Yeah, so that is correct for the civilian tenders. For the Navy tenders, they're huge, basically machine shops.
Mm-hmm.
So the crew is 1,300 people, which is quite large when you think that a frigate or destroyer will have 250 to 350 mm-hmm. Crew members on board. Mm-hmm. So it's a very large ship, and this was a submarine tender. We could essentially bring any submarine operating in the area come alongside for any kind of repair with a 4-hour notice, which was really wonderful. It was kind of an out-of-the-way place, which is what we desired. But that was a very interesting tour, but it took place during 9/11.
Mm.
And like for me and everyone else, life really changed after 9/11. But we can talk about that more later. The other overseas tour was in Malaysia.
Uh-huh.
And that was one of my last tours, second to last tours. That was 3 years. And I was a Navy captain by then. I was the attaché for the Navy. So I had three bosses. I reported through my Navy chain of command out of Pacific Fleet in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
I also had a Defense Intelligence Agency boss back in D.C. because attachés gather information and mm-hmm. intelligence and report back.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third boss is the ambassador. And he is the representative, in this case he, the representative of the president on site. So it was a very interesting job to combine both the Navy liaison, maritime security. We were really working closely with the Indonesians, the Malaysians, the Singaporeans, and the Thai to some extent to try to drive down the incidence of piracy in the Straits of Malacca. But then whatever the ambassador had on his plate that he had to deal with, we worked to support that. And it was a very busy time for the Navy. We had 65 ship visits in 3 years.
Wow.
And I can compare that to a couple of years earlier, and I think they had 4 or 5 a year.
Wow.
So
wow.
It was really a wonderful experience, and it was the first time that they had had a woman in the military from the U.S. Mm-hmm. be posted to a Muslim country there as a senior attaché. So it was interesting learning culturally as well.
Well, that gets me to my next question. I was going to ask you, and you answered it, but let's go into it a little bit more. So you got to interact both personally and professionally with people in the host nations. So what were some surprising things you learned about some of the places and countries? And did you make friends with some of the locals?
Yeah, absolutely. We lived out, my husband and I, you know, Rick and I lived out in town in each of those duty stations except Italy, being the base commander. Of course, I lived on base, but it was a small island, so we got to know everybody. So we interacted in each of these locations, you know, personally, socially, professionally, and we really came away with some wonderful friendships. We enjoyed it very much. I would say the postings in Europe were very easy. It's just they were very accepting of the American military there, and especially, you know, in those two countries. Malaysia was interesting. So when I was first stationed there, I had a week turnover with the attaché who was serving before me. So he took me around and we met everybody. And I remember meeting the Deputy Chief of Navy of the Royal Malaysian Navy. And he turned to Bob and he said, "So Bob, how is this going to work with Claudia being a woman in our country, a Muslim country, with our culture and our traditions and our way of dealing professionally, mostly with men?" And Bob said, "Well, why don't you ask Claudia?" And I turned to the Admiral and I said, "Admiral, it's going to work like this. I represent the United States Navy. If you want to deal with the United States Navy and try to solve some of these problems of securing the Straits of Malacca and improving your maritime security and decreasing the incidence of piracy with our Navy, then you deal with me. And if you don't want to deal with me, then you can call the Germans or the Koreans or any other Navy. But that's how this is going to work."
And how did that work?
It worked great. And it was interesting because we got along very well, that admiral and the follow-on admirals after him. And he said, "You know," privately, toward the end of my tour, he said, "You know, you've really taught me so much, and it's important that I had that lesson personally, because I've passed that along professionally to my officer corps. Just because we have things running a certain way in our country doesn't mean we're not going to be open and interact with other countries and navies and people who have different backgrounds." And I really appreciated his feedback on that because I learned the same. Just because things are different in, for example, a Muslim country, it doesn't mean they're wrong. It's just the way that they're doing it. And so often I think it's important to live in a different situation and listen to people and observe how things are done. And if they're treating each other well and nobody's getting hurt, there's a lot of different ways that we can do things. And I want to tell you one more example, Therese, from this situation. So I was the first, you know, before we go into a duty station, we go through language training, you go through whatever the training pipeline, and it was a long one. it was over a year before we went into Malaysia because of the nature of the job and the language.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So my husband, Rick, and I both went through a lot of the training together.
Mm-hmm.
And as I'm going through the training with Defense Intelligence Agency, one of them is just social events. How do you, you know, eat, behave, interact at a very formal dinner party?
Right.
So, So you know, we're going through the seven forks to the left, seven knives to the right.
Right.
And I said, you know, that isn't the way it's going to be done in Malaysia from what I hear. And they have a separation where men and women eat separately and interact separately, even in professional situations. How am I to handle that? And they said, well, we trust you'll do it just right, and please let us know so that we can train those who come after you.
Oh, so they didn't know either how it was going to work, huh?
No, they didn't. And when Rick and I were there, one of the first things, he's invited to join the, quote, Wives Club.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because it was 37 men attachés and me,
mm-hmm.
and about 35 wives, and then Rick.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the Pakistani attaché's home for a dinner, and there were two rooms set up, and one with all the male attachés and one with all the female spouses. And so we're greeted at the door, and they bring us in, and I was just waiting to see where they were going to escort us to.
Mm-hmm.
So both of us were brought over to the room where the men were. And they said, well, of course, you're an attaché, so you have to be with your peers. But Rick is a man, so he has to be with the men. So we both went in there, and after about 5 minutes, Rick got up and left, and he said, you know, actually, I am working with those spouses. And he left, and he went over there. And about 10 or 15 minutes, a couple of the male attachés says, you know, I talk to you guys all the time. I want to go interact with the women. And it ended up a wonderful evening where people just move freely between both of the rooms.
Oh, that is so interesting. That's very cool.
Yeah, it was a good experience.
So I have one more question. I know that during Desert Storm, or maybe it was the first Gulf War, there was conversation about female service members needing to wear head coverings out in public, not hats, but, you know, like shawls or scarves. Was that something that you had to do as well, or did you just, or were you okay with just your military uniform, or did you have to do something special because you were female?
So, I think, excuse me, that was probably a little more of an issue earlier on.
Mm.
I was in Malaysia, 2005, 2006, and 2007.
Mm-hmm.
And Malaysia is a very integrated country. They were a former British colony, and the Malays
mm-hmm.
are all Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
25% of their population are Chinese Malaysians. They are not Muslim. And another probably 10% of their population are Indian Malaysians.
Mm-hmm.
And they are not necessarily Muslim. So most of the people, when we got there in 05, most of the women were not wearing head coverings.
Mm-hmm.
And it increased a little bit, but it was never anything imposed or expected or even requested of expatriates. And I went back to after I retired for 3 years when I was working on my dissertation, because Rick was working at the embassy. And we saw a lot more head coverings by the local Muslim women,
mm-hmm.
but it still wasn't predominant, and it still was nothing they expected other people to do. So there's a big difference between the Arab Muslims
mm-hmm.
and then some of the other different Muslim religious communities within other cultures.
Okay. So it sounded like you had some good mentors as you progressed up the career ladder, and some of them were like kindly parents. They said, okay, Claudia, you go out and solve this problem on your own, and we'll be here to sort of, you know, tough love, but tough love there. But so did you have good mentors as you went up the career ladder, and what were some of the lessons that they taught you?
Yeah, I certainly did. One of the first was Admiral Bobbi Thompson, and she was a senior female in the Navy when I came in, when I was stationed in San Diego in 1982. And I was working for a male Commodore, and I was talking to him during the semi-annual counseling. And I said, "So what are my opportunities as a woman?" And he said, "Oh, Ensign, I don't know. I'm sorry. But, you know, Captain Hazard, she was a captain at the time, she's stationed here, and I know her, and you should meet her, and she'll give you some advice." So he set up a lunch where I could go and meet with Admiral Captain Hazard. Mm-hmm. We had a wonderful conversation, and she told me a couple of things. And I think this is actually something that pretty much remains the same guidance that women are giving other women or men to other men. If you're working in an industry or profession where you're the minority, you have to always do your absolute best and always know that whatever you're doing is going to be deemed as either a success or a failure to you individually, but also broadly to the aggregate. So if Claudia Reisner fails at a certain duty station, it's going to be unlikely that the Navy detailers are going to put another woman officer in behind her, sadly. Whereas if John Smith doesn't do well, they'll just put a different guy in there. So we were still in that culture. And then I asked her about the different leadership tours. And she said, whenever you have an opportunity, take a leadership tour and make absolutely certain that the name of it is very easy to understand for men and others who don't work in your specific career path. For example, when you're on a ship or when you're on an aviation squadron, or even ashore, we have specialty tours where you're kind of a staff officer working on certain skill sets. And then you have leadership tours, your division officer, department head, executive officer, commanding officer. She said, don't go into jobs that are the equivalent of, because when you get before a selection board, they're going to be looking at 100 different records. And if yours is confusing, people aren't going to get it. They don't have the attention span. So you have to be division officer, department head, officer in charge, executive officer, you know, commanding officer, commodore. And I remember that throughout my entire 29 years, and I was every single one of those leadership, I filled every single one of those leadership tours, and I think that helped contribute to my success. Another really wonderful mentor I had was a commanding officer that was actually my boss out here when I was recruiting in Albuquerque. And his name is Jay Carrizales, and he still lives in Albuquerque, and he remains a dear friend, just a wonderful person. But in recruiting, it's very challenging because young people are recruiters, and they're living in rather remote areas as far as not being close to headquarters. And they have a lot of autonomy, which is not what a lot of junior sailors have. And they can get into trouble. So we would have captain's mess, and the sailor would get in trouble. The chief would bring him in to the command. Command master chief would talk to him. I was the XO, would talk to him. And if I recommended that the individual had to go to captain's mess, it would go to captain's mess. And some of the offenses were trivial. Some of them were pretty serious, and some of them really made us wonder if that individual was suited for continued service. And a couple of times I was a little disappointed with my commanding officer because Jay would not punish them in the manner that I thought they deserved. And I asked him, you know, the one or two times where I didn't agree with him, and he said, "Claudia, always err on the side of your people. You can't go wrong." He said, "Good order and discipline is not just about punishing. It's about showing the example to every other sailor in the command and letting them know that nobody's perfect. There is not zero tolerance. People make mistakes, and there's room for them to correct, to learn from it, and then they will be very loyal and steadfast in continuing on with their service most of the time." And he was exactly right, and it was a wonderful lesson for me to learn.
That is cool. So, you know, on the same vein, you know, you've served in some interesting times, like you've already alluded to, you know, the Iron Curtain, the fall of the wall, the fall of the Iron Curtain, and 9/11, and then the Gulf Wars. I was wondering, were you in Europe during the fall of the Iron Curtain? And also, what about Don't Ask and Don't Tell? That was during your time, and also its repeal came during your time. And do you have any memories or specific stories that you want to talk about, you know, these kinds of events?
Yeah, sure. Let me start with 9/11, mm-hmm. you know, because that was just a huge milestone. Mm-hmm. I went into Italy in August and took over the commanding officer. And, you know, I'm in charge of a lot of different things. We're running a Department of Defense school. Mm-hmm. We've got the medical clinic, dental. We've got housing. We've got all the logistics for the ship. We interact with the ship and the submarine squadron. It was a varied job. We did stuff out in the community. I was part of the Rotary Club. We had community relations projects. Mm. And then 9/11. So I have 2,700 Americans overseas on a tiny remote little island, and their world is coming apart on TV in New York. Mm-hmm. And we really had no idea what was going to happen. And everyone in the military, we immediately went into a full lockdown. The ships were sent underway. We got our ship underway. We didn't know when she was coming back. We had no communications. They went out dark and silent. The families were quite distraught. A couple of the family members came up to me, the wives, and said, "You have to fly us back to New York. When something goes wrong here, that's our evacuation plan." And I said, "Well, think about that. New York's under attack. We're not flying you back to New York. You have to stay here. This is the safest place you can be." And then we spent days and weeks working with the families and having them understand that this was the very best place the military could have them, and that we were going to take care of them. We were going to protect them. Our master at arms force was, you know, 24/7 out roving patrols. The Italian Carabinieri, the Italian military, they all came to me and said, "Anything you need, anything we can do, we are here for you." Complete solidarity. And it was wonderful. It was just such a strong sense of community, of people pulling together. And the families then understood, and they calmed down. But it just struck me as so counter, you know, intuitive to me that we would try to send somebody back home. We weren't even flying, and we certainly weren't going to put them on a ship. Right. So anyway, that was 9/11, and force protection became one of my primary roles for the entire remainder of my tour there. And it has remained, you know, much more. You know, we used to be able to drive on and off bases with just an ID card or a sticker on your car. Now you've got an obstacle course, you know, and barriers and armed guards and all that. So things have changed.
So what about Don't Ask, Don't Tell? What happened then, and then, you know, maybe what happened later?
Yeah, okay. So, you know, when I joined the Navy in 1981, I knew there were LGBTQ officers and enlisted personnel serving with me. You know, it just didn't matter, because before my career in the Navy, I had gay and lesbian friends from, you know, school and work and, you know, around the neighborhoods where I grew up in Chicago. In the Navy, I was a fleet support officer, and I always worked ashore. So people's competence, you know, and their dedication to duty, their patriotism, loyalty, love of country, dependability, all of that, that has nothing to do with their sexual orientation. You know, just like any other job, we all work together as a team, trying to get, you know, things done, accomplish our mission. And I was very proud to serve with everyone I served with. So, you know, seriously, in my experience, I never saw sexual orientation as a threat. You know, it wasn't a threat to good order and discipline, or unit cohesion or readiness. I did see how hard the policy of prohibition was, though, on those who wanted to serve, and then those who already were serving their country in the military.
But they did have to be pretty secretive, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They absolutely did. It was nothing blatant. But again, you know, when you're not berthing with them, when you're not on a ship, it's just you come to work, you do your work at the office mostly, you stand watch, and people go home. So it's different than serving on a ship or a submarine, where it would be more apparent.
Yeah. All right. Well, so do you remember the repeal as well?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I remember the repeal. And it was an interesting time. I've got a really good girlfriend who lives here in New Mexico. So many Navy people end up here in New Mexico.
It's the weather. And, it's the weather.
Yeah, exactly. And the blue sky.
Yeah, yeah.
She was actually on the task force at the Pentagon during Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And she worked very, very hard. And they were with some senior officers. And I remember Ann telling me at the end of it, she had no idea how any of the senior officers, including the general that ran that task force, personally felt about the issue. Mm-hmm. That's how professional they were. They just kept it to themselves. It didn't matter. They were there to study how this issue would affect the readiness of the military. And their conclusion was that it is not detrimental. And when that came out, that was in, I think, 2011, and I was stationed in Norfolk. I was in major command there, and I remember the admiral calling all the commodores, commanding officers, and command master chiefs together in a conference room, and he said, so this is what's going on, and this is the military's decision, and tell me what you think about it. And he went around the room and he asked each of the command master chiefs, which is the senior enlisted individual in the Navy, and then us COs and commodores. And one or two of the command master chiefs said, this isn't going to work. There's going to be a problem. It's going to be distracting. It's going to be a little unnerving. It's going to be detrimental. I don't support it. And the admiral didn't say anything. We went around the room. Say there were 20 people there. Two people had an issue. The others said, whatever the Navy decides, it's an order. Aye, aye, carry on. And then we convey that strong leadership down the chain of command. And he asked those two command master chiefs to rethink it and come see him in the morning, either with their letter of resignation or their pledge that they have gotten over this personal issue and that they are going to deal with this as professional Navy leaders.
What happened?
And that's
what happened? I'm curious.
They both understood that they could figure it out and that it was actually unprofessional of them to have... It wasn't unprofessional to voice their feeling. It would have been unprofessional for them not to have carried out the order.
Right.
And they were professionals. Some of them had been in over 30 years. And I think there was some real soul searching at home that night. And they realized this is change. And that's one of the things, Cersei, I have to say I really admire about the military. It's not an organization known for quick change. But when it happens across the organization. And it is implemented. And people say, aye, aye. They salute. And they carry on smartly. And I really like that.
Well, and so I wanted to kind of fast forward to now, you know, and there's been some interesting things happening within the military, even in the last few weeks. But for this conversation, we want to talk about, you know, we're in a pandemic, and within this pandemic, we're experiencing economic hardships and mass demonstrations and sharp political divides, you know, some very nasty rhetoric, nation coming together in solidarity. It's a very interesting phenomenon to see what's going on out there around the world. Our coronavirus numbers are rising all across the country, and the death toll is staggering. What are you seeing in your neck of the woods in New Mexico?
Well, you know, you and I both live out here in the East Mountains. Mm. So I only know of one individual locally here who had COVID-19. Mm. And she was a young woman, and she recovered, and she seems to be fine. I just haven't heard of any others. Mm. On the other hand, there are a lot of older and some retired people out here, many with compromised immune systems, who are really locked down. Mm. They are extremely cautious, mm-hmm. and realize how vulnerable they are, because as I read through the daily news coming out of New Mexico, we're up to 9,250 confirmed cases. We've got 3,806 that have recovered, mm-hmm. 200 are hospitalized, 410 are dead. And whenever you read about the new deaths, the majority seem to have pre-existing underlying conditions. Mm-hmm. So they were vulnerable and they were weak, and it killed them. Mm-hmm. And it's just terrible. So people are extremely cautious. I work at the food pantry here in the East Mountains. Mm-hmm. Rick and I volunteer on Wednesdays. Mm-hmm. And we always wear masks. We wear gloves. All of the clients who come stay in their vehicles. Mm-hmm. We ask them to wear masks. We maintain distance. It used to be that you could come in and shop at the East Mountain Food Pantry. Mm-hmm. We shut it down. We pre-pack all the boxes. We'll have one of the volunteers go out with a sheet and ask what they would like a shopping list.
Right.
And then we pack them inside the facilities, and we deliver them to the back of their car with them sitting in the driver's seat. And we're so happy that we have not heard of any of our clients who have caught it. Mm. And none of our volunteers are, although a number of our older volunteers have decided to stay home. Mm. But we've got new volunteers that are coming that are a little bit younger and healthier. So it seems to be working well. I think the key is we're in a rural state, mm-hmm. so it doesn't spread as quickly. You don't have the same number of contacts, obviously. Right. The other thing is that the governor came out early and hard, not knowing what this was going to be like, and shut things down, because we've got a very low ratio of hospital beds per capita, right. in this state, and mm-hmm. we could have easily overwhelmed, you know, that capacity. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. now it's just opening things back up at a rate where we hope that we can stay within the capacity of our medical system to treat it, and we certainly don't want, you know, our frontline workers to become ill or hospitalized. Mm-mm-mm. So it's, you know, I hear a lot of people are saying, well, it's our lives or our livelihoods. And actually, I think that's a false choice. I think it's our lives and our livelihoods. Mm-hmm. And we're just kind of walking a fine line, mm-hmm. trying to make sure that we stay healthy and that we, you know, can survive this economically, because it's very tough. Mm-hmm. It's really hard. My husband's youngest brother in New Hampshire, he and four other members of his family all have COVID.
Wow.
It's a small state. It's densely populated. Two of them were hospitalized. One is still in the hospital a month later on a ventilator. We don't know if he's going to survive. And he's my age. The younger brother was in the hospital 2 weeks on oxygen. He's been home 2 weeks. He's still on oxygen. He's a 30-year retired National Guard veteran. Perfect health. You just never know how it's going to hit. So it shook us up a lot, and we're very concerned about them.
Mm.
So I hope people retain the sense of community that I've seen demonstrated out here, for example, in the East Mountains, the donations, the volunteers to the food pantry, mm-hmm. the sense of people wearing masks to respect others and try to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
I hope we continue that, because there's no reason to become divided mm-hmm. over a medical issue.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of us saw the video clip of Captain Crozier leaving his ship after being removed from command. You know, that's the Teddy Roosevelt was the ship. because some of his crew had tested positive for COVID and were ill. So what was your reaction to the situation? And of course, I know we don't know all the facts because, you know, that stuff is kind of kept private by the Navy. But so I wanted to know, what was your initial reaction to the situation? And then what is happening behind the scenes, do you reckon, based on your own, you know, experiences, to determine if he gets reinstated or punished or what? What happens usually in these kinds of things?
Yeah, good question. I was very upset when I saw that he was fired and the manner in which he was fired. And when I listened to the remarks of the then acting Secretary of the Navy, Moseley, I just thought it was extremely unprofessional for Captain Crozier to have risen to the point to command one of our aircraft carriers is a spectacular feat. We have 11 carriers, almost 100% of them then become admirals. Mm-hmm. He worked very hard. I have to assume that he did everything right and that everybody trusted him. And when I saw the clip of him leaving, I could tell that there was a very good command climate. That's one of the things that we use to judge how well somebody is doing in command. It doesn't mean that everyone has to be happy,
right?
But there has to be an open sense of communications. We're willing to talk it out. If we disagree, we do it in private. If we agree, we do it in public. Same with, you know, to praise and to punish. So I was very distraught that it happened in that manner. I wrote a letter to my two senators, Senator Udall and Heinrich, and also to Congresswoman Holland, and express my dismay. I didn't think it should have been handled that way. I know that there are two conflicting perspectives. There's two sides to every story. Why didn't he just stay within the chain of command? Why did he go public? I don't know him. I have to assume that based on that professional successful record, that he tried everything he could in the chain of command to get their attention to what he thought was an imminent threat to the safety of his crew. And that's one of his primary missions, besides war fighting and accomplishing your other missions, is you have to protect your crew and you have to remove a threat. You have to do everything you can. There's no place to hide on the carrier. You've got 5,000 to 6,000 crew, depending on whether or not the air wings embarked. And they're tight quarters. There's open berthing. There's open messing. So I think he did everything he could. He opened it up a little more to try to get more attention, and it went viral, and they fired him, and they removed him.
So in your experience in these kinds of things, so is there like a captain's mast for a captain, and they're talking about this, or is what happens now? I know people have been calling to get him reinstated, but there's a process that would happen, right? What kind of process happens behind the scenes that...
Well, so I received a letter back from Congresswoman Holland's office saying that the House Armed Services Committee had sent a letter to the IG requesting a formal investigation of what the Acting Secretary Moseley did. And the new Acting Secretary, James McPherson, apparently has the results of that, and that is being looked at and moved up the chain of command. I don't have any insight from there.
I think,
you know, unfortunately, sometimes the longer something takes to be resolved, people forget about it, and you don't have the same social pressure to take a certain action. I think because it's taken so long, there must have been some serious questions that they really wanted to address and understand of why the captain did what he did, as well as what actions the acting secretary took. So I hope it's resolved soon. If they will either, you know, they probably have three options. They will either expect him to retire. They could ask him to stay and allow him to go to another command. Or they could reinstate him as commanding officer of the aircraft carrier USS Teddy Roosevelt. I just don't know. I don't have any insight.
Right, right. No, I was just wondering how the Navy works in these kinds of things. Well, that was really interesting, and that's a good, you know, that's a good explanation is what's going on behind the scenes. Because, you know, when you have the news reporting it, it's out there in the news, and then 2 days later, it's silent. And so I was thinking there's stuff happening behind the scenes. I want to switch gears again. I guess we've done that a bunch of times, but so now you're running for the state Senate, New Mexico State Senate. And I imagine there are a lot of people out there who really care about you, including your husband, saying, Claudia, why would anyone want to go into politics these days? So I wanted to ask you, what are you telling people that are asking you, why on earth do you want to do this?
Yeah, boy, isn't that the $64,000 question, huh? You know, I never wanted to go into politics, Cersei. I never thought about it. I moved 19 times in 29 years with the Navy, and when I would get to a new place, typically I would go out and volunteer, work with some organization. I did it in my different duty stations in the U.S. as well as overseas. Mm-hmm. You know, I got involved with some of the local churches, the Rotary Club, the Navy League. Mm-hmm. I used to teach adult literacy, including in math. And so when Rick and I left Malaysia a few years ago, we came back to New Mexico because I was here recruiting in New Mexico, and in fact, New Mexico really recruited me. I knew I was coming back here. I just love this state. Mm-hmm. And Rick and I got married here. So we came back and we jumped out and we started to volunteer at different things. And I had just finished my doctorate degree in international studies. Mm-hmm. And my dissertation was on politics, the economy, and climate change. So I decided that I wanted to organize different panel groups to talk about climate change and what we could do here in the East Mountains and in New Mexico, because, you know, it's a big threat everywhere. And I wanted to help people learn from experts on how to make our communities and our environment more resilient. Mm-hmm. And as I'm meeting more and more people, they said, you know, why don't you get involved with the party, with the Democratic Party? I said, yeah, okay, why not? So I went to a meeting, and they were voting on offices, and I volunteered to be the precinct chief and chair. I volunteered to be the ward vice chair, mm-hmm. and I got into that. And then I volunteered to be on the state platform and resolutions committee so I could learn more about issues and travel throughout the state to hear what New Mexicans think about the important issues that we're facing.
Right.
And a few of the local leaders asked me if I would run for Senate. And I said, I've never thought about it. And they said, well, think about it. You would be very effective at the state level. You're a proven leader. You know how to research. You know how to listen. You care. You're volunteering. Think about it. And I did. I spent about 3 months. And I met with a number of different people and read a few books, as we doctoral folks tend to do, right, Cersei?
Yeah, exactly. Always read.
Solution's always in a book.
Yeah.
And I decided that I would like to do that. So I am running for Senate District here in Senate District 19, and I just want it to be a continuation of service. I've served my country for all these years. I've served my community in different ways, and I continue to do that. And I would like to help represent the constituents here, regardless of their party, up in Santa Fe to make sure we've got a strong voice listening to the specific things that we need, but then also representing everybody in the state so that we can come out of COVID-19 and whatever that post-pandemic world will be. It will always be a more cautious one, but economically, how do we be more decoupled from oil and gas? How are we more resilient? Mm. All these important issues, healthcare, education, I want to be part of that solution, and I want to listen to a lot of different people and come together in committees and hash out some solutions. I've done that for years in the military, and I don't think, frankly, it's all that different in the civilian sector, but who knows? I may be surprised, but I'm willing to put a lot of time and effort into it because I really do care very much for the people in this district, in this state.
So you said you were going to work across the different parties, and you know, with all the partisanship and the divide in the country, how will you kind of extend a hand across to work with other people?
Well, you know, when I talk to people, and I talk to Republicans, some Democrats, I talk to a lot of declined estate, you know, independents. Mm. We always start out and they say, so who are you? What are you? And I say, you know, I'm a veteran. I served in the Navy for 29 years. And that's greeted very warmly. Mm. A lot of people appreciate that. And then they love to tell me the stories about their family members who also served.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a discussion. And then I start talking about issues. And I keep it on issues because, frankly, that's why I'm interested in doing this. I want to address issues and try to solve problems. And when people will say, well, what do you think about this that's going on in D.C. or that? And I said, you know what? It's crazy times. It's very interesting. Mm-hmm. But, you know, let's focus on this and let's see what we can do. I'm not drawing a big line between me and D.C., and I want my focus to be right here in New Mexico. And people generally are very happy to talk about issues, and I don't see the big divide. It doesn't come out in those conversations. That's not across the board. Some minority few are a little rude, and they said, you know what? I just don't want to talk to you. And I said, you know what? I appreciate your time. Have a terrific day. Thanks. And you move on.
So talking about issues and thinking from the perspective of a veteran, what issues do you think that we should be addressing for our military families and veterans, you know, in New Mexico?
Well, we've got a large population of veterans, over 10% in mm-hmm. this state,
mm-hmm.
and I think the national average is between 6 and 7%. You know, I don't have a specific pinpoint number because we have veterans dying every day,
mm-hmm.
so it just changes that often. But a lot of them live in the rural areas of our state,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of their issues are similar to other people who live in the rural part of the state,
mm-hmm.
where we need better connection. This digital divide isn't mm-hmm. working. We see, especially with people being forced to learn, teach, work, and even deal with their medical providers at home, telemedicine, all the other different programs set up, we need to have reliable broadband. It has to be fast. We have to address this right now. I know people have been talking about this a long time, but I think this pandemic is throwing this right in our face.
Mm.
New Mexico's future is going to be directly tied to us bringing broadband to every house, every school and shop in the mountains, out on the ranches and the farms, and out on the reservations, the Pueblo lands.
Mm-mm.
We have to be connected, just like we had to have electricity years ago.
Mm-mm.
Some of the unique issues for the veterans is, of course, we go to the VA,
mm-hmm.
and there's one VA hospital. We are the fifth largest state geographically
mm-hmm.
in the Union, mm-hmm. and we have one VA. That's a long drive. So telemedicine is critical. Not all of the vets need to come into the VA, especially now with the pandemic. We right. don't want to have these huge clusters and concentrations of vulnerable people mm. around other people who are ill.
Mm.
So that is really becoming one of my top issues, is this rural infrastructure. The other thing, a lot of our Veterans Affairs and benefits are all through D.C. I think our role here at the state is to make sure that we have those bridging
mm-hmm.
organizations and agencies that make sure that we get the benefits that we have earned and all veterans and military family members have earned and deserved, that they're delivered to us here in New Mexico. And I got to say, Deb Holland, for example, is a fantastic advocate for veterans. You know, mm-hmm. her father was Marine Corps.
Yeah, she's a brat.
She understands exactly.
Yeah.
You know, my husband's from a military family. Both of his parents were in the Army. His brother was National Guard. So there are a lot of people touched by the military. I think one other thing I would like to see here is kind of an umbrella organization that would do a slightly better job of connecting all of the wonderful nonprofits, for-profit agencies and organizations that are set up in New Mexico to help veterans, to make sure that they're not stepping on each other's toes, so they're not overlapping, and so that nothing's falling between the cracks. So those two things, we need to be a bridge and we need to have an umbrella here.
You sound like you've been thinking about this for a while now, so good. very good. I wish you the best with your future plans here. You know, we've been speaking for quite a long time, and so we need to wrap it up. And I just wanted to give you a minute more to talk about anything, maybe how your Navy career has prepared you for this moment, or anything else for that matter. So you have about a minute. So anything you would like our listeners to know?
Thank you, Sarah. Thank you so much for this opportunity. It's really been nice. Mm. It would have been so nice to be sitting with you over at the museum doing this face-to-face, but you know what? Life can't stop. We just have to adapt.
All right.
And I'd like to say that, you know, on that note of adaptation, everything I've done in my life in the Navy, you know, each new duty station, you have to learn, you have to adapt. You jump in, you look around, you keep your mouth shut, you figure things out, then you ask a lot of questions, and then you just carry on, and you try to make things better so that, you know, when I would leave at the end of a one-year tour, two-year tour, three-year tour, I wanted it to be better than when I got it. Mm. And I think if we transfer that same kind of open-mindedness, collaborative work, working in solidarity as a community and as a state with each other, we can figure out all of these very challenging issues that we're facing right now and talk about a lot of different options, choose some solutions, and take care of each other. And I think that kind of adaptation is going to continue throughout my whole life. And my point is, I like to stay positive. Mm. There's always a negative side, but you know, wherever your focus goes, that's where your energy flows. Mm. And I want to focus on solutions and improvements.
Well, that's a good philosophy. So I just wanted to wrap it up by saying that our podcasts are supported in part by New Mexico Arts, the New Mexico Humanities Council, Sandia Area Credit Union, as well as organizations such as Military Brats Registry and Military Brats Seal. And I wanted to thank you, Claudia, today for joining us, and it's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It's been my pleasure, and I really appreciate so much what you and your dad and the others are doing. You're a spectacular leader within our community, Sarah, and I admire you.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.